It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore a 13-year journey to fight for the union movement on factory floors in Milwaukee and Kenosha in the 1970s and early 80s. The union activity of Local 72 becoming a model for militancy and rank-and-file auto worker democracy. Join in on AMC Plant Memories, American Motors Corporation, assembly plants in Milwaukee and Kenosha. Questions about union activity today? 800-642-1234. John Melrod is here. His memoir is called Fighting Times, Organizing on the Front Lines of the Class War. After graduating from UW-Madison in 1972, he spent 13 years in Milwaukee and Kenosha at factory jobs, organizing fellow workers and rising through the ranks of the United Auto Workers Union. He is a retired human rights lawyer in California. John, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you very much, Kate. And it's a pleasure to be speaking to people who've heard of American Motors and the Pacer. Usually when I speak to a crowd
you're right
outside
at home.
Of that area.
Yeah. You're right at home in Wisconsin, yes. So, you wrote your memoir to answer questions that your kids have asked you about your life. And one of those was, why did you go to work in a factory after graduating from UW-Madison? What was it about that that change in your life?
Well, my kids really were flummoxed. And let me give you a moment's background. In 2004, I was diagnosed with terminal pancreatic cancer. Mm. And in the surgeon's report, he directly tied that cancer to industrial toxins, particularly trichloroethylene, which we used at the Kenosha plant. And I had used it in other factories that I worked in before that, as well as tanning solvents. I also worked at Press Steel Tank that used to be along the beautiful Milwaukee River. But in those days, there were five tanneries dumping waste right into the river. And it had a horrible stench and, of course, couldn't be used by anybody. But in any event, I was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer and only given 6 months to a year at most to live. And I had a 7 and a 10-year-old, and they did come to me and they said, Dad, this is just, why did you do this? Your life is being jeopardized now because you went to work in a factory. So my first instance of answering that question was really to try and leave behind, because I thought at that time it was going to be impossible to beat the cancer, was to leave behind an explanation of why I had done what I did, why I had been willing to incur difficult work environments, difficult, exposures, because I felt so deeply about the need to change the social order. That the social order was fundamentally unfair for poor and working people, and that I wanted to be able to devote my life to doing that. Unfortunately, working around toxic chemicals was some collateral damage I suffered along the way.
So
in terms of, making that
Well, I was going to say, at the time you weren't focused on the toxic exposure, but you were focused on building solidarity, on resistance and, what you saw as capitalist exploitation of workers.
Well, that's very true. Although sometimes I'll say that they go hand in hand, because, when I say there's a class war, if you're being instructed to dip your hands in barrels of trichloroethylene without protective equipment, that's because the company has decided there's a cost-benefit ratio to whether they're going to provide protective equipment. Mm. And at that time, I don't think people knew as well as they do today that trichloroethylene had such an effect on altering the genetic composition of one's body so that you have these errant cancerous cells develop over time.
I'm going to reintroduce you here for a moment as we talk about union organizing with John Melrod, author of Fighting Times, UW-Madison student from 68 to 72. You can join in on Factories, What You Remember, 800-642-1234. Let's take a call now. Patrick joining us from Milwaukee. Go ahead, Patrick. Hello.
Hi. Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I'm from a union family from Chicago, a union tile setter family. My dad was on his hands and knees every day of his life working in the old style tile setting. He taught us to respect hard work. Now I'm 60 and doing okay as a restaurant owner. But I've been having this vision of the union failing in this one of a few places, but they don't promote themselves. And I have a friend that's a union teacher organizer in California that gets upset when I say, how can you guys never say, like, hey, the last, you know, not the teachers union, but the last library built in your beautiful city, Milwaukee or Chicago, wherever, was built by the union 105, you know, bricklayer mason or the, you know, they never promote what they do. And I know that takes money, but the union needs to be the squeaky wheel. And we only usually hear about a union is when, well, another 1,000 union jobs are lost, you know, and it's always in a negative way. So that's my promote the union and the beautiful, the great things it does.
Look at the positive aspects of it, Patrick is saying. John, go ahead.
Well, I really appreciate what Patrick's saying because he's right. I mean, there's not enough of a tradition in this country to look back at our history and understand the difficult struggles that unions went through to win what we've got today. And that needs to be much more popularized. Although I will say that in recent statistical analysis, there are a higher rate of people today who support unionization than there have been in the last many, many decades. So there is an understanding and a feeling of the importance of the role unions play. And, you know, I think a lot of that has come about because of the, what I like to call the new union movement, the lifeblood that young people at Starbucks and Amazon and REI and many, many more are breathing back into the union movement, making it something much more vibrant, much more relevant to today's issues. I work with a group of young Starbucks organizers in the Northeast area, just talking and consulting with them about tactics and, you know, what I learned and what's applicable to what they know. And they've set a model for me. They say our union is transactional. And I didn't even know what that meant, to be honest. I almost had to go ask my kids to find out. But with transactional, I mean, what intersectional means is that the union deals with many, many more issues than just what's occurring on the shop floor. Dignity, wages, vacation, that's part of the package. But in addition, there's a much more, there's a consciousness of the world we live in and the environment and the existential threat right now that exists in this country, and that unions need to play a much more progressive and leading role in that movement. And that's something that's just, yes, go ahead.
But I hear echoes of that in what you wrote about, that you weren't just fighting for, you know, about the forced overtime and about the speed up of the auto assembly line. I mean, you were taking on racial intolerance and taking on racism and sexism and white privilege. So, I mean, I can see the intersections there as well.
Well, I think, yes, that's very true. We were very conscious of sort of breaking the movement we were hoping to build and did build into both an economic component and a political component. So at the same time, for instance, I was a steward in the Kenosha plant trying to win a fan for people on the line during the summer, or whether it was taking up the issue of civil rights and marching with other trade unionists demanding a day in commemoration of Dr. King's birthday, we did look at a intersectional movement. It wasn't quite as broad as it is today, but that was a part and parcel of it. And just interestingly enough, it was Kenosha, Local 72, that won the very first holiday celebrating Dr. King's birthday before the rest of the UAW internationally had even taken that up in bargaining. So Wisconsin's been a precedent setter in a lot of ways for many, many years, going back to the formation of the, what wasn't then the UAW, but it was an AFL-CIO union in 1933 in the Nash plant.
John Melrod's new memoir details years of turbulent life in Wisconsin factories fighting for worker protections on the assembly line. Join in about unions past and present. Your memories, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with longtime labor activist and union organizer John Melrod. His new memoir is a glimpse into the determination of the 70s and 80s shop floor unionizing, speaking out against racism and capitalism, rallying for militant organizing in the auto industry in Milwaukee and Kenosha. John behind the labor newsletter Fighting Times, which had been a loud voice against auto industry concessions. Join in on this era on Wildcat official strikes, 800-642-1234. The book is Fighting Times, and John Melrod stays with us. Let's bring in Julie in Madison. Julie, hi.
Hi, can you hear me?
We can, yes, go ahead.
Okay. I work in a union company. I am advanced engineering. We try, most of us in the group have come from union backgrounds, and we're wondering what the best way to support our plant union is.
Julie, thank you. John, what advice would you give?
Yeah, Julie, that's a really essential question, because in many cases, the unions have become a bit ossified and, a bit slack. And one of the first things that we always paid attention to at American Motors was participatory democracy, really involving the rank and file. In my case, one example was when I began to move up through the union ranks, I decided to, under the auspices of the Education Committee, set up a labor school. And for 7 weeks, either before second shift or after first shift, about 250 workers, stewards, and just activists used to come together and study all kinds of components of union life and union organizing. And it was amazing the interest that was there. So I often think it's unfortunately on the union leadership's part that things get held back, meetings aren't scheduled. But the key to it is really to let the rank and file exert its power and play a role. When I was elected department head, I was chairman of a certain department, the trim department, in the Kenosha plant. I started organizing monthly departmental meetings and putting out agendas and bringing in outside speakers. And the reaction was really positive. I mean, people were getting carpal tunnel syndrome working on the assembly line. And we brought in health and welfare experts who addressed how to file, workers' compensation claims if you have carpal tunnel, why it comes about, what we can do to try and correct it, which I then, as the union representative, went out to the company and said, we need to rotate workers on different jobs because they're getting these repetitive injuries, tendonitis injuries. So I think that is a problem nationally, but they're in many places. For instance, I just read that the United Food and Commercial Workers has a caucus, a reform caucus, like we were in the Kenosha plant, like I wrote about in the book Fighting Times, that's defined itself as trying to, you know, both democratize, militarize the union so that it really stands up for people. And these reform caucus in the Food and Commercial Workers is demanding that they have the right to vote for all officers, something we just won in the United Auto Workers after battling for it at many conventions. And they want more money put into the fund for organizing unorganized workers. So I hear you about the problem that does exist. And all I can say is if we don't try and drive the car ourselves, it isn't going anywhere.
I was intrigued too how you were such a communication guru or a newsletter guru. I mean, passing out so many pamphlets between shifts and really focused on communication and transparency. What impact did that have?
Well, you know, it's funny. One of the reviewers who reviewed an early copy of Fighting Times, and it's up on my website, JonathanMelrod.com, where there's a lot of information not in the book. But in any event, the reviewer said, we've read the book and it's a really interesting book. It's inspirational, but we really never came to the part about John Melrod's personal life. And I said, well, that's a pretty astute comment, because he went on to say maybe his personal life was his political life. And we were very dedicated. I mean, this was not, you know, just a 8-hour work day. You know, we were at night, we were producing leaflets. We focused on two major issues. Now, something I learned in looking back on the book as I wrote it was we were really determined to fight racism and racial prejudice in the factory and in the community, as well as to take on the issues of misogynistic treatment toward women, both in the union and in the company. And we really waged those battles in many, many ways. If a report got to us that there was racist graffiti in the bathrooms in one of the lakefront plants, and it was really some horrible graffiti all over, and it said, you know, we're all slaves, but let the N workers do the work. And we worked with some people who had passed a mass petition, a mass grievance in the area. And they were, 8 of the signers were white, 8 of the signers were black, and 1 was Latino. And it was a pretty rainbow of people. And everybody wanted that racism taken off the walls and felt that it was destructive to the solidarity that we felt as union members. So those issues really occupied us at night, running off leaflets. There were many other members of the caucus who put in the same kind of work that I did to make this whole thing happen.
And it
with
wasn't
the United Workers.
It wasn't just the leaflets. It was the buttons and the T-shirts and the stickers. And then people would be wearing this on the assembly line. And so you could see, I guess, visually see the solidarity.
Well, it was. It was really a resistance movement. When we were sued for defamation by 4 foremen and a superintendent's son, and we were able to discover that American Motors was surreptitiously finding and orchestrating that particular lawsuit. And I'm sorry, what exactly had the original question?
No, that's okay. I just wanted to make a point, and we're going to go into the news break here, but that you found this real true camaraderie when you wore T-shirts and had stickers and had all these visuals of showing your unity.
Well, I was going to say, when we were on defamation trial in Racine, in Judge Flynn's court there were hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands of people in the shop who wear buttons every day that said, defend free speech, save the Fighting Times. And the initial funding of our defense came from people at the plant gates who contributed thousands of dollars to help us pay for legal counsel. So there really was a lot of support. I mean, hundreds of people wore United Workers Caucus jackets that were defined sort of as these blue nylon. You knew that was United Workers Caucus. So there were many aspects of that were a movement that weren't just tedium or what we did when we put out a leaflet. But you're right, a camaraderie, picnics on the weekend, social events in the evening, breaking down barriers between men, women, you know, black and white, and creating a sense of unity and solidarity.
John Milrod, giving us his first-person account of being part of a vital moment in the labor movement in Wisconsin for 13 years. The new memoir is called Fighting Times. Join in on the unions, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. With a union, John Milrod writes in his new memoir, workers are afforded a degree of protection from the ravages of working on a monotonous assembly line. We get insights into unionizing in the AMC Kenosha facility in the 70s and 80s, which was known as the oldest continuously operating auto plant in the world, where unfinished car bodies, John points out, still needed to be trucked across the city for final assembly. Join in on this organizing, this labor history, 800-642-1234. John Milrod's book is called Fighting Times and stays with us. Let's bring in Lindsay in Madison. Hi, Lindsay. What's on your mind?
Yes, good morning, Kate and John. Thank you for taking my call. I have a slightly different take on union solidarity in the Madison area. In the 90s and the early 2000s, I worked for a United Food and Commercial Workers Union shop at Tub Foods on the west side. And in the early 2000s, I think 2002 or 3, Cub Corporate decided to sell all the stores. And I know that that was made public. But I'm thinking back, and I can't think of a single white-collar union representative, much less a delegation of white-collar union people from, say, state employees union or others, showing up to protest the sale and try to save the union shop. I also remember when Act 10 went through in 2011, all the white-collar unionists were calling upon blue-collar union members and white-collar union members to come up and act in solidarity with them to try and save their jobs. And I've lived in Madison for about 2 decades, and I've been aware of the class difference, both in society and in union politics. And I just think it's rather disingenuous that in 2011, white-collar unionists were pleading for union solidarity when they didn't provide any solidarity with the blue-collar union at Cub Foods when their jobs were on the line and ultimately were lost when Metcalfe's bought them. And, of course, Metcalfe's is a rabidly anti-union corporation.
Lindsay, thank you so much for bringing this up. John, go ahead.
Yeah. I one thing I have to say before I answer Lindsay is I know I'm in Wisconsin when there's a minute of news on deer hunting season. you know, that they used to have such trouble trying to run the AMC plants when all the deer hunters wanted to take off. But Lindsay's point is very good in that there's an old union slogan, an injury to one is an injury to all. And what that really means is whether you're a white collar union or a blue collar union, you're union. And that's a principle of solidarity that existed, you know, very strongly coming out of the 30s and 40s. And I fear that what the unions mistake that the unions made was they transitioned to becoming what we call business unionism, that they were more concerned with memberships dues and with, you know, increasing the salaries of the top administrators rather than getting down there and doing the hard and dirty work of bringing people together. Because you're right, those picket lines should be twice the size. Both the workers who work there and the workers that are asked to support them. When I was working at American Motors, and it must have been around 1970, 74, 75, there was a strike, I believe it was at McWhite Wire in Madison. And at that time, I had been elected to the bargaining committee, which was the executive board. And we had launched a campaign. The strike had been going on for months and months, and they needed support. So we sent all the stewards out to collect money on the American Motors plant to help the strike support fund. Well, I got a call from the chief steward, who I was above in the hierarchy, saying they just fired me and the steward for collecting funds for the McWhite strike. And I went over there and I told the superintendent, you got to put him back to work. He's doing nothing illegal. This is something that we've done in this plant since 1933, take up collections for fellow workers. And they fired me. So at that time, the president was Rudy Kuzel, and he brought in the entire bargaining committee at about 9 or 10 at night on a Friday night and told the company that they had to put us all back to work or they'd be facing a worse consequence, and they did. But that came from Rudy Kuzel, who had been a tremendous, you know, unionist from a young age and really understood the underlying principles of the union, which really have to be an injury to one is an injury to all.
Along those lines, which I thought was so interesting, is getting people to walk off the job together. And I want you to just take a moment and talk about the 1201 walkout and galvanizing workers on all shifts to follow through, walk off the job, which puts their future employment at risk.
Well, I have to thank you, Kate, because I think you read a lot of the book and have a pretty good understanding. You know, what happens is there's a contract every 2 or 3 years, and there's a lot of focus placed on it and a lot of excitement in the plant. But often what happens is that the international union brings in their lawyers and their bargaining people, and it's sort of taken out of the locals' hands. Mm. Well, that wasn't true at American Motors. We had a tradition of independence, and I'm just trying to remember exactly what the original question was.
No, that's okay. And I just guess, walking out together and...
Oh, excuse me. That's sure. So obvious. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no. And it's a very intimidating situation because, mm-hmm. you know, when you're in a factory, the power is held by individual foremen, some of whom may be decent, some of whom may be not so decent. And they exert a lot of discipline on the factory floor. So when the contract expires at midnight, there's a tug and a pull. The company's trying to keep you on the job because they know if the industrial discipline breaks, people will walk out. And so we used to have a plan that at 1201, first of all, we'd sell hundreds of t-shirts that would say 1201, no contract, no work. And then when it came time for the expiration day, we'd have, for instance, I had worked with a group of guys who were in a black motorcycle club and gave them all whistles. And when 1201 came, they started blowing whistles all over the department. And other people started chanting, "On strike, shut it down." And thousands of people streamed out of the plant at midnight, and we held a big, massive rally on 52nd Street. You know, because you do risk your job. I mean, something I admire about these young people in Starbucks, they walk out if there's discriminatory treatment by a supervisor or a store manager, or there's something egregious that occurs, they walk out and they're willing to stick together and put their jobs on the line. It's no different in a big plant like American Motors, where, you know, people get worried. Their livelihoods, their pensions, their support for their family depends on their job. But the beauty of the union in American Motors was it took care of people. Mm. And people didn't have to live in trepidation and fear of speaking out or filing a grievance or writing up a foreman for doing union work. So a lot of it has to do with, you know, what the union's ability to mobilize people. In our case, we had both the union and the rank and file caucus. And that's very important because the rank and file caucus is more in tune with those people on the assembly line and more in touch and is able to wield a lot of influence in determining what direction the union will take in. Ultimately, it's the union that has to do the bargaining and, you know, the negotiating, but it's a strong rank and file that makes that happen.
John Melrod with us, the new book, Fighting Times, Organizing on the Front Lines of the Class War. Let's bring in Tom in Racine, who worked at American Motors Corporation in the early 70s. Tom, what's your story?
Hi, John. I just want to say that back in, those are some pretty exciting days. And, basically what was happening was, you know, the union would helped establish, you know, really excellent benefits for the rank and file. Nothing like we have today. I mean, you had real dental insurance, not these discount plans. You had excellent medical coverage, and you know, it fought for fair wages, and it was really exciting times. And you know, workers really did feel very empowered. And as a side note, I know my dad was in supervisory, and I was on the line, but they would benefit, the supervisory corps would benefit too from the contracts that the union would establish and benefits that they would achieve, because very often they would then copy essentially copy the contract benefits and bestow those on the supervisory corps. So it was like, you know, everybody won, you know. Mm,
there was a ripple effect. Huh.
Yeah, management as well as rank and file would benefit from the efforts of the union itself. And today, individuals have no power versus like these corporate hit squads and, you know, legal teams that they have to break unions. And the only answer is you got to organize, you got to get together.
Tom, can I ask what happened to you after working at AMC?
Well, I moved on to other things.
Mm-hmm.
And, I was able to save enough money working there to go to college and got a college degree. And, wound up in, other
ventures. Yes. Tom, thank you for that story. John, go ahead.
Yeah, I'd like to thank Tom for that story as well, because he's absolutely right. Those were pretty exciting times when we felt like we could really accomplish anything we set our minds to. And, you know, those days were just days filled with, you know, what change we hoped to make. And people were able to lead a decent life. I mean, pay was good. You know, Tom mentioned dental and the healthcare, but it went beyond that. I mean, there were pensions. There were pensions that supplemented your Social Security. And there was a lot more security in being, you know, in the working class and in particularly a member of a union. So even where there weren't unions, unions benefited. I mean, non-union workers benefited from the strength of the unions because it raised the wages and it raised the conditions under which people worked and lived for everyone. And that's something people tend to forget today, that unions have historically played that role very prominently in raising up the wages and the working conditions of workers all over the country.
John Melrod took his political activism from UW-Madison in the early 70s to the factory floor, becoming a militant rank-and-file auto worker out of college and rising through the ranks of the UAW, transforming Local 72. Still time to talk about the unions, improving working conditions, fighting racism, sexism. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with political activist and union organizer John Melrod. His new memoir gives us this detailed look into what it was like to work in the assembly line at AMC plants, American Motors Corporation in Milwaukee and Kenosha plants, and how his rank-and-file caucus, they fought tirelessly for workers and their contracts with AMC management. Join in, 800-642-1234. John Melrod stays with us. Let's bring in Nancy in Grafton. Nancy, what are your reflections on unions?
Well, years ago, I worked at a nursing home here in Ozaukee County, county home. And anyway, my husband, of course, was a union worker, and I thought, you know what, we ought to get a union in over here. And so there was one other lady, and the two of us worked together at it, and we got the union in at the county nursing home. And, you know, they really didn't want to have me there anymore because I was a union person. And so one time they went and they said that they had to have two people to get a certain person to a bathroom. Well, there was nobody on the floor at all to help this man except me. And so I thought, well, he's, you know, I got to take him. So I did. Well, then they decided to fire me because they said that I was not doing it properly. And so the unions went to work for me. And I got a big amount of money back. I got my job back again, and I stayed, and the union stayed too. But I'll tell you, nowadays, they do no longer have a union there, and they get all these agency people. There's agencies, that's businesses, you know, that hire people, and those are the people that work at the nursing home now. It's not the local people. It's not the people who...
They're hired through agencies.
That's right.
John, I just want to... Nancy, thank you for that. John, your reflections there on what Nancy is saying, especially about hiring through agencies.
Well, that's become a large problem across the country. And unfortunately, I think it began to an extent when the unions in auto allowed in a two-tier wage system. And what that did is it created a divide within the workforce. And I think that management all over the country has used those certain divisions among the workforce to take back what workers like Nancy won by fighting to bring in the union. So, you know, hats off to Nancy. I know it's Wisconsin when somebody says, my husband's in the union and it made me want to organize the union. It used to be a hell of a union state. And, you know, I hope that as things go forward, we'll go back into that direction. Would it be all right, Kate, if I just mentioned that the book is on sale at 50% off right now through the new year?
And thank you for that. I want to just a follow-up question, perhaps along the lines of what Nancy is saying. What role did the National Labor Relations Board have in this era and with court proceedings? Did it help to defend workers' rights?
Well, I was fired in 1973 after we had fought Speed Up on the assembly line. And at first we took it to the union because we had the right to strike over all grievances. And there were hundreds of people at the union meeting. And basically everybody would say that we won the vote to call a meeting for a strike vote to win my job back. But the president of the union ruled otherwise, and the back of the room was filled with police. But the NLRB came to my defense. And after about the first 9 months, the administrative law judge wrote a blistering opinion attacking American Motors for being McCarthy-like, for taking us back to the 50s, for firing us, for being involved in activities to protect wages, hours, and working conditions. And they ordered me reinstated. And although they ordered me reinstated, the company refused to do it. And for the next 2.5 years, I had the experience of working in Crucible Steel Foundry, Pfister and Vogel, and Press Steel Tank that used to be out in West Dallas. But after that 2.5 years, the Seventh Circuit Appellate Court ordered the enforcement of the reinstatement order, and I was reinstated. When I left in 1985, the Racine Labor Paper had a front page article that said, Melrod 7, American Motor 0. And those were the 7 NLRB cases that I had won, and American Motors had won 0. So the NLRB, although it may not have the same teeth it did then, is an agency that should be utilized wherever possible. You've got to use every tool, every quiver in the hour, in the every quiver, every hour,
we
arrow
got it.
In the
yeah.
quiver.
yep.
Yeah. Excuse me.
We,
you know, when you're in a fight, because you need every tool you can. And in some cases, that is the board.
We are short on time, but I want to fast forward to the present. Tony from Sturgeon Bay gets us there, called in wondering your thoughts on Elon Musk and Twitter. Elon Musk has said his employees should expect to work hard or to leave. And Tony asks, is this the new sweatshop? Do the employees have any hope of organizing?
Well, you know, Tony hit on one of the most egregious situations in the country right now. And it's, you know, I've read a lot of Twitter posts because tech workers are beginning to organize. One of the unions, the Alphabet Union, is at in tech. And had there been a union at Twitter, there would not have been a boss like Elon Musk who could run amok doing whatever he wanted, basically destroying his own company. That there would have had to be an orderly process of bargaining and, you know, taking into consideration what he wanted to change, what the union was willing to change. And as it is now, it's a disastrous situation. Same as when I spoke at my first bookstore, a young junior college student got up and asked me, Mr. Melrod, what would you say that I should do if I wanted to change the world? And I said, well, if I was your age, I'd go to work at the Tesla plant, because what could be better than bringing a union into the heart of Elon Musk's empire? So basically, that's what I think of Elon Musk. He needs to be brought down a notch. And in my view, it should be the unions that do that.
John, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you very much. And I hope people go to my website, jonathanmelrod.com. You can directly buy the book there by clicking a link and saving 50%. So thank you. And it's great to be back to Wisconsin, even if it's by telephone.
John Melrod, author of Fighting Times, now a retired human rights lawyer in California. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.